Bloody Elbow presents Crooklyn's Corner, a hodgepodge of current event topics from the combat sports and entertainment community. Here is your host, Crooklyn, a.k.a. Steffi Haynes.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Crooklyn's Corner. I'm your host, Crooklyn, but most of you now know me as Steffi Haynes. And joining me once again is my bestie here, the Crooklyn's Corner Emperor himself, Mr. John Nash. You sit on a throne here. You know that, right?
I would believe that more if I hadn't listened to you with Eugene, and you gave him pretty close to the same intro.
I hope not.
I hope you don't. Yeah, my throne's probably made of sharpened swords of the enemies. That's very difficult and uncomfortable. So
it's the bones of the enemies that you've crushed.
Well, that sounds a little better. I'll go with that.
All right. So once again, we're here to talk some finance, and lots of things have been coming out here over the past weeks, months. It's been about 2 months since I've had you on, and so many things. But I guess I want to start with something fairly recent, and that's Dana White's claims that UFC fighters are more financially secure than boxers. Now, you have been doing comparative analysis going back to, I believe, 2013, 2014 of both boxing, I believe Golden Boy, and the UFC finances. So could you break some of that down for us?
Well, I'm trying to remember what was Dana White's exact quote, just so I get him right. I think he said something along the lines as UFC fighters, especially at the bottom, make more than boxers.
Right.
I think that's what he said. I'm not 100% certain. But anyways, I have over the years taken a look at boxing and mixed martial arts and compared the two. Recently, I took the released in court filings a breakdown of Golden Boy's finances, because we got them from their lawsuit with Al Haymon's PBC, and I compared it to some of the UFC finance stuff that we got from the lawsuit. And the thing is, Dana White's right that UFC fighters make more than boxers on average, that the average UFC fighter makes more, especially at the bottom. But that's kind of misleading, because when he says UFC fighter, he's talking about fighters just in the UFC. That's one promotion. They promote a very small percentage of the total number of MMA fights. Mm. And he's comparing that to boxing, which covers everybody from the club show guys that are making, $100 a round to Canelo Alvarez. So there's a wide stretch of boxers that he's comparing to. And basically the UFC promotes only the top MMA fighters. So that's a little misleading. But when you look at them comparatively, like top MMA fighters and top boxers, or MMA in general against boxing, boxing on average easily pays more than MMA on average. But when we're talking on average, we're talking about fighters much below the UFC level. So you're talking about, guys that are in the regional shows. But the median boxer, I'll have to double check, but I'm pretty sure it was around $2,750 or $3,000 was the median boxer, compared to about $2,000 for the medium MMA fighter. So there's a lot more money being made by boxers overall at the bottom end. And part of that, too, is some just weird stuff. Like there's minimum round payments by a lot of regional promotions. So if you fight in some states, you can't get less than $50 a round. Well, the minimum amount of boxing rounds, 4 rounds. The minimum amount of MMA rounds is 3. So right there, boxers are making $50 more, just based on that regulation. So little stuff like that. But then you get up to the UFC level, and it's true, though, that comparatively, UFC prelim fighters, the fighters basically in the top 15% of all fighters, that's what UFC basically level is. That the minimum level UFC puts you in the top 15% of MMA fighter pay. That's higher than the similar situated boxer. But when you get to the very top, let's say the top 5% of both sports, suddenly see boxing overtake MMA again, and it just blows it away. The top few percentage of boxers are making multiples of the top MMA UFC fighters.
When you say multiples, are we talking 2 times, 3 times, 10 times?
Well, it can be all those. I mean, it's a good comparison. If you take a look at, like, let's say the 135 division, and MMA and the 135 division in boxing. Well, in MMA, you have a few guys making pretty good money. You got Yan, you've got Sterling, the champion, Aldo. all probably making, you know, maybe up to $1 million or more. That, yeah, if he gets into pay-per-view points, several million. But then you look at the boxing side, and you've got Javonte Davis guaranteed several million every time he's fight. Lomachenko's getting $1 million or more than $1 million every time he fights. You just go online, Haney, Garcia, those guys are getting $3 to $5 million when they fight now. Mm. So you're talking, generally speaking, in boxing, the top, the guys that hold the belts, which can be up to four, because there's four belts that matter in boxing, plus all the guys fighting them in title fights, then so the top anywhere from 5 to 8 fighters in each weight class are making more than MMA fighters. And so while a top guy like Conor McGregor, people aren't making 5-10 times what he's making, usually the UFC champions sometimes make more than the boxers, but the guy fighting the UFC champion, who might be only getting a few hundred thousand, the comparative challenger, his opposite in boxing is a challenger. Those guys are probably making 5 to 10 times what you'd see. I mean, look at Kambosos when he fought Lopez, Teofimo Lopez. Kambosos was guaranteed like $1.5 million or something. It depended because there's a whole problem with the purse bid, you know, with Triller not honoring the purse bid. But I think he ended up making like $1.5 million from that fight as a challenger. Well, UFC challenger, the contract might give you a bump up, but that challenger, that bump up might only be $250,000,
$350,000. And no points for the challenger.
Yeah, no points for the challenger. In this case, there was no points for Kambosos because it was a purse bid, so it's a flat sum. Mm-hmm. But yeah, when you're negotiating in boxing, often the challenger or the two people, if they both have titles, or whatever, they'll negotiate a split and they'll get a percentage, you know, based on whatever the total revenue brought in. And it's not just pay-per-view. You can ask for a piece of the gate. My understanding is Woodley, when he fought Jake Paul, he got not just his guaranteed $2 million to show. He got, if it did beyond a certain level, and I think it did a little bit, he got a percentage of the pay-per-view, a percentage of the gate. You know, basically they pooled a lot of the money together, and then when it reached a certain level, he got a piece of that, of everything.
I want to backtrack for a second to two people, and that's Bud Crawford and Canelo Alvarez, because they have unique deals in that they are not tied to a promotion. Break that down a little bit for us and why that is super beneficial, but not everybody can do that, because Tyson Fury is going to be in a position to do that as well.
Yeah, if he chooses to, he might choose to stay. Anthony, I mean, then there's also the position that Anthony Joshua and Kambosos is, where they're not tied to a network, that they're free to shop their fights wherever they want.
Right. And Canelo and Bud Crawford are the same, because Bud just right there while Bob Arum was standing with him said he was taking his little fight game elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, and then Canelo and both Canelo and Crawford don't even have a promoter. Right. So they can work with any promoter, any channel. And what that is basically, yeah, they're not tied. But because the way boxing works, because the promotional, first of all, because there's no UFC that basically is such a juggernaut that they all the revenue goes to them. And also because the promoters don't control the titles, the sanctioning organization are separate. So you have the ability to negotiate a title fight without having to deal directly with the promoter that owns that title. And so they can set up the situation where top guys like Crawford, who has the title, who now has no promoter, but he still is in possession. He doesn't have to give the title back to leave the promotion. He gets to keep that title, and other fighters want to fight him for a chance at the title. He gets to negotiate what he wants, and Canelo's in the same boat. Right. And, you know, and Canelo's money, too, is – you know, we've seen, I mean, the thing about Canelo is a lot of people, I remember when they announced the deal with DAZN, and a lot of people thought the money being discussed was made up and he doesn't really get that paid. Then the lawsuit comes out or the commission reports, and it shows that yes, he not only did he get $35 million from DAZN for the TV rights, but he was given he got to keep a big split of the gate, the ticket sales and sponsors and foreign Mexican TV rights. So he had all this other money on top of that $35 million.
Amazing. I love it, though. I really do. I wish that there was a way that could happen in MMA, but I'm sure you're going to tell me that is a long time coming. Snowball's chance, probably. So let's move on. Why is it so hard to fight out your contract in the UFC without renegotiating a new one? And why is it not only difficult, why is it risky?
Well, with the UFC, it's gotten easier to fight out your contract. In the past, it was really hard. because the UFC has, I think we've discussed this many times, they have all these contract provisions in the contract that allows them to exert a lot of leverage on you. They can basically have coercive contracts. So the UFC, first of all, you're going to have a multi-fight contract, and every time you turn down a fight, they can extend the contract 6 months. And we just saw that with Nate Diaz turning down the Chimaev fight. They extended the contract for 6 months. We also saw Francis Ngannou. Situation Francis Ngannou was even kind of worse because they supposedly, according to Francis, they offered him a fight he couldn't even possibly make because he had to go get his visa renewed. And so he was absolutely unavailable for that time period that they offered him the fight. He couldn't take it. They extended it 6 months, then made another fight offered at another time that he couldn't possibly take it, even though he said, hey, listen, I'm available just a few weeks later. Again, another 6 months. So they have this ability to offer you fights, and if you turn it down, they can extend it 6 months. And so you could technically, if they're very clever, if they offered you, supposedly they did this in the past, that after a fight, when the commission would report that you had a medical suspension, they'd automatically send you an email saying, hey, we're extending your contract because you're unavailable. And then they'd build up all this time, this extension period. So if they wanted to, and then you got to the end of your contract, they could say, well, we still have a year to year and a half left in your contract if you don't resign. And then extend that at the end, add that to the end. So fighter careers are short. So you have this problem that if they want, they can just keep adding a lot of extensions and make it very difficult to get out. On top of that, they can also offer you fights you don't like. I mean, Nate Diaz and Dustin Poirier supposedly came to an agreement. They want to fight. The UFC, I doubt, is going to offer that, to give that to Nate Diaz. Because if Nate Diaz, that fight works for both ways for Nate Diaz. One, if he gets pay-per-view points, he gets some money out of it. But two, win or lose, it's a fight that's not going to damage his brand. People are going to still look at Nate Diaz. Oh, you fought in a big profile fight. I'm aware of Nate Diaz is still out there. Or, oh, you beat Dustin. You're still a hot commodity. I think that's why their goal is to offer Nate lesser known fighters that are very tough, because likely he'll lose to them and then he'll lose some of the rub. Nate's over the hill. Or if he beats them, it's not a big deal because they're not well-known fighters. There's not going to be a ton of interest in that fight. And so if Nate keeps turning them down, they're going to keep extending the contract. So it gets really hard. But I should say there is some good news for fighters. And this could be a huge year coming up the next year or two. We could see a lot of fighters fighting out their contracts, possibly entering the free market. And not just, fighters that we saw before, but big name, potentially pay-per-view fighters. And that's because after mid-2017, after the first class period ended for the antitrust lawsuit, and when the new class period started, the one filed by CB Dolloway and Cajun Johnson, that class period, the UFC has changed their contracts. They now have multiple changes to the contract, so they're not nearly as restrictive as they were before. And so there's also almost every contract I've seen, and now at least one per year after that, and several for some years, every contract has a sunset provision. They have a term limit to the contract before they could go on forever. Now they say something like they cannot go more than 4 or 5 years.
Wow. Okay. That still seems like forever. And that's definitely a period that could spell doom for a career, especially, say, a 35-year-old fighter.
Oh, yeah, it definitely is. It's not the greatest thing in the world. But let's say you're Nate Diaz. He would have been a free agent. Nate Diaz's career lasted 7 years. But if you signed a contract in 2017, at the end of 2017, that means that contract, if it's a five-year contract, it'll be up at the end of next year no matter what. If it's a four-year contract maximum, then it's going to be up at the end of this year. So there's potentially a lot of fighters that, are bigger-name fighters that have hung on. I mean, Zane Simon pointed out that if you go back 6 years ago, 2015 rankings, 25% of the fighters that were on the rankings 6 years ago are still on the rankings. And so there might be a sizable number of fighters that are still highly ranked, still have some prestige around them, some value, that have the potential to say, hey, you know what? I have 1 year left in this contract. Instead of resigning, I'm just going to wait it out. And then if I don't like the fight they offer me, I will just wait out and leave on my own terms. The thing is, when did Nate sign that contract? I believe it was 2019.
Mm-hmm.
So he does not have the benefit of, I mean, at the earliest, if it's a 4-year contract, the earliest possible, he could get out of it in 2023. If it's a 5-year deal, he could get out of it in 2024. So he doesn't have the benefit of other guys that might have signed before that of saying, I'm going to wait out, because that's not 6 months. That's a couple of years down the road.
Right. Okay. Now, I do want to talk to you a little bit about Morgan Stanley's upgrade of UFC stock and what the term overweight means.
Well, what overweight means is they think the value of the stock should go up, that it's underpriced. And so I think they set the price right now at $30, I think it what was trading at the other day. So overweight means that they're saying that this eventually the stock for Endeavor should rise to about $39 mostly because of the value of the UFC.
Why is it so valuable right now? And I'm going to tie that into a sponsorship question, but first tell me why it's so valuable right this moment.
Well, Endeavor as a whole, why it's valuable is because the UFC is doing gangbusters. And their William Morris talent agency is going to start taking off because they're shooting more stuff because the COVID protocols are starting to wane. So there's more production in. But the UFC, they're just doing gangbusters business. They're having a record year, close to probably $1 billion revenue, 50% margins. So that section of Endeavor is printing money for Endeavor. And they also assume that not only will that continue to next year, it'll just get better for Endeavor. So that's a big part of why they think the Endeavor stock is undervalued.
Do you think they might be gearing up for a sale?
No, I don't think so, no? Personally. I mean, because the UFC is such an important part of Endeavor. But who knows? I mean, I don't have inside track, but I would say no, because it's what does Endeavor have right now besides a ton of debt if they don't have the UFC?
Okay. Well, I mean, if they were to sell it and pay off their debt.
Well, that's a possibility, but then I would not see them out buying other sports franchises like the minor league baseball. They're trying to build a package of sports properties to bundle together. And I just don't think that they would be doing that if they're planning on selling.
Okay. We're going to talk about sponsor stuff here. The next couple of questions. The first being, there's this giant boom in UFC sponsorship this year. Is that because the UFC capitalized on the COVID crisis last year and this year, especially last year and the beginning of this year when other sports weren't happening and the UFC was? Is that why sponsors are just dying to throw money at the UFC, or is it a longer term thing? Please break that down for me.
Well, I think that's a strong possibility because the UFC was the only sport, you know, being broadcast that it looked like, well, here's something people can see. I'm putting my money into something that actual people will watch, and the ratings are going through the roof right now. Why the lockdown's going down, why the pandemic's going, the other sports aren't playing. So sponsoring the UFC is a better value. I also think a big part of it, though, is that the UFC, a bunch of dominoes fell in place for the UFC to take their sponsorship to another level. And that was one, they got legalized in New York. So now they can be held in New York. And that was something that a lot of sponsors were waiting for because they're based in New York and it's something important to them, because without New York, they didn't quite see, well, it's still a fringe sport. So that was one. And they wrote about it during the sale that New York was going to lead to a big increase in the value of sponsorship. The other one was getting the ESPN deal, right? Well, before that, another one was getting the Reebok deal before the UFC deal, because the Reebok deal cleared the Octagon out of all the competitive sponsorship coming from the fighters. And now there was actually a lot less space in the cage for sponsorship, because before you could pay a fighter, he put up a banner or wear it on his trunks. And so there was a lot of other avenues to get seen on a UFC broadcast. But now the only way in was going through the UFC. So that increased the value. And then finally get on ESPN, because ESPN did a couple things. One, it made it a much more of a legitimate sport because it's the standard bearer for sports. And also it's getting on ESPN after a year or so, it seemed to elevate the viewership numbers. And so it was a much more valuable property. Then throw in the final thing is that they've worked heavily, very hard to expand the foreign markets. And now, so if you're being sponsored by the UFC and you're a product that's sold all over the world, It's like, well, it's not just limited to the U.S. and maybe, you know, Brazil. It's now in China. It's now in Russia. It's now in the Middle East. There's a wide audience to get. So all that, I think, helped it. But the other thing is the UFC is not picky about who they get as sponsors. I think that helps it, too. You see sponsors for the UFC that I don't think you would see with other major sports. I don't see the NBA with a medical marijuana company or a marijuana distribution company or with cryptocurrency on the uniforms. The UFC is willing to take money from much more fringe sponsors because it's like we've set our level of the price we want and we'll basically take it from anybody that meets that price.
And that brings me to cryptocurrency. Now, I got to get your take on this because you're a smart financial mind. And I could not help but laugh at your tweet with the Kevin Lee thing where that he is accepting his purses from Khabib's promotion. Eagle FC just signed a 4-fight deal and he's getting paid exclusively in Bitcoin. And you remarked that it had to have come from a meme generator or something along those lines. And it just cracked me up. But I got to get your take on crypto.com and this whole burgeoning thing with cryptocurrency being intertwined with the UFC and other MMA promotions.
Well, first of all, I'm not a big crypto guy. I don't think it doesn't offer anything real per se. It's not a real currency. It's not very accessible to be, you know, you can't go to Target and suddenly buy something with a, you know, with your Bitcoin. I will say though, I'm not surprised it's taken off. I mean, I remember you had a show towards the beginning of the pandemic and you asked me what should have people invest in, and I didn't put my money in any of these, and I wish, you know, I probably should have because all of them really took off, but I told people put them in monopolies and Bitcoin went up like tenfold right after that, and of course I didn't put any of my money in any of those, so I didn't listen to take my own advice. I didn't get a reward out of it. But Bitcoin, there's a large number of people, two things. One is a large number of people suspicious of the current system, the current economy. So they want to invest into something that's not a fiat dollar run by government. They're kind of anti-establishment. And so this gives them an opportunity to do that. The other thing, too, is I think there's just a general appeal because Bitcoin, in many ways, has just been taking off and the people investing it have no clue why it's going up. But they get to feel smart because it keeps rising. And so they keep promoting it. Then other people are like, oh, I don't want to miss the Bitcoin train, so I'll put my money in. And so that's a big part of why I think Bitcoins and cryptocurrency at all has been taking off, because it's for a lot of people that it's a runaway train. It's a bubble that they want to jump on. And I mean, who knows? It might, it's a bubble in the sense it's slightly inflated, but it might not ever really disappear. But no one wants to miss their chance to make money on this because it seems like everybody's making money. And so for MMA, it seems to be a large segment of MMA fighters that it really appeals to. And I think a big part of that is that MMA fighter, it's also the type of demographic that likes Bitcoin. You know, men in their 20s and 30s, generally, you know, maybe not a professional class, which I mean by professional class being like lawyers and high end, you know, people making huge incomes. No, it's generally people that have some sort of income coming in, but are not don't have access to the high paying professional class jobs. But this is a way to see see their money grow quickly. And I think that's part of the appeal. That, I mean, MMA fighters fit that description perfectly.
Flat earthers.
Well, yeah. I mean, I get along great with John Fitch when I talk about him, except when I talk about Bitcoin, you know, or cryptocurrency and stuff like that. Those are the guys that live for this.
Huh. So, all right, let's backtrack for a second here. Elon Musk puts out a tweet, and whatever he tweets out, if it's about any kind of cryptocurrency, like the headline yesterday, he made a tweet about Dogecoin and it went through the roof. So when you have characters like that can manipulate the crypto market, I mean, how does that shake out?
Yeah, I mean, that's a problem. There does seem to be a lot of manipulation of the market, you know, so I mean, I don't know. There should be, you'd think there'd be some sort of regulations, but there's right. not a lot of regulations. I mean, the problem with cryptocurrency too, especially like Bitcoin, what's the future with its energy usage?
Yeah.
Because a lot of people want, we're going to be the capital of Bitcoin and they're going to come here and do your Bitcoin farming and everything. But then they're like, oh my God, it's just driving up the cost of energy here. We don't want you anymore. And so that's a concern if you're a person investing into Bitcoin is what happens when there's nowhere to when no one wants to be the place that all the Bitcoin's being minted at. Right. I mean, I don't know. I'm just not a big cryptocurrency guy. So maybe there is a solution to that. But I look at that and I just don't see it as something. It's not a real product.
See, that's how I look at it. And I don't trust it. You know, it's not tangible to me. I think it's all a scam.
I mean, my spidey sense goes up, but maybe there's something real there, but I can't analyze and say, oh, you're offering a real product for people that's very useful. You know, it's not a smartphone. I can, you know, show me when you, someone showed me the iPhone the first time and oh, look at all the stuff you can do and make phone calls. They go, okay, that's going to sell a lot because I can see the function of that. I can see the function of an electric car. I can see the sale. I can see even video games, but I don't Bitcoin. The whole point of Bitcoin is you buy it because you assume that the value is going to go up.
You assume. Oh my goodness. And then you have NFTs and I don't understand that either. It looks like a gift to me and it looks very easy to copy and steal.
Okay. NFT is a straight up scam. I mean, there's an argument for cryptocurrency because you're basically saying we want a type of currency asset that's not, isn't dictated by the government. Right. So it has this kind of this, that can be protected, that can't be cloned and that you have access to, that you have some safe way to store your money. NFTs are just like, I mean, shit, I could just be, NFTs are just, it's an imaginary item that you're selling that you don't even own.
And therein lies the problem. I just do not get it. But I mean, I'm getting off track here. I want to go back to the sponsorship really fast because I do notice that there are some bigger sponsors coming in, though. I couldn't help but notice that the UFC clock, the fight clock, is now sponsored by Timex.
Yeah, the UFC is selling anything in the UFC to a sponsor. They have the clock they have that with a sponsor. They have the weigh-ins are sponsored. They have some of the divisions are sponsored, like the light heavyweight division sponsored by a truck, an industrial truck or something. I can't remember what company does it. So, sponsorship's really taken off. In 2015, the year before the UFC was bought by William Morris Endeavor, sponsorship totaled $52 million. They claim that it's gone up fivefold under them. So that would put it about $260 million. I don't know if that's accurate, but Morgan Stanley puts their sponsorship numbers now, sponsorship, advertising, and licensing at over $200 million. So that's, no matter what, that's an incredible increase in the value of sponsorship money. And they're putting more and more effort. They still have large premier type sponsorship categories that they haven't filled yet, which if they do, will add tens of millions of dollars to the revenue.
But that's money that the fighters won't probably see a nickel of because they only get Venom money, correct?
Well, on the uniforms, yeah, the fighters are guaranteed the Venom pay. We know what that pay tier structure is. But on those uniforms, they have a Monster Energy logo sometimes. So Monster pays for that. The fighters get none of that. Crypto.com
right.
has a logo, and they're paying on average, supposedly $17.5 million a year. It's the biggest sponsor for the UFC. None of that is earmarked to go to the fighters. And then, of course, there's all the new sponsorship around the ring on advertising during the shows, that none of that's guaranteed to go to the fighters.
And that is just a travesty. My goodness. Now, the reason I've focused on sponsors so much, because again, another funny comment from you. Now, day before yesterday, there was a big hullabaloo about COVID kits not being covered by the UFC anymore. And Ariel Helwani broke the story. And at the time, that he had hard proof that the new policy wasn't going to cover the kits that the fighters and their corners used before they flew out. Now, they were still going to cover the two kits from the time they arrived at the airport on through fight week. but the ones that they had to do because they have to provide a clean test before they actually travel, they were no longer going to cover that. I firmly believe that Ariel Helwani was on the money and that the blowback was immense and they didn't like the look of it. And so they amended it, changed it, whatever, and then decided to throw Ariel under the bus. But when Ariel came back and said, hey, I've got hard proof of the then change, I believe him. And so you made a comment that they missed their opportunity to have UFC branded COVID kits. Could we see something along those lines?
I mean, theoretically, but I just don't see them doing it because it would, the cost of making the COVID kits and then or purchasing them. And I don't see them doing that. I don't know much about the story because I heard that, you know, I saw the stories posting, quoting Helwani. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if he reached out to the UFC and they refused to comment or if he didn't ask the UFC for comment. I can't imagine. I would imagine they asked for comment. Mm-hmm. So, it is possible that the UFC just changed their policy and, you know, and that's actually what happened. And just no one got back or none of but the UFC is also famous for not really informing the fighters when they do stuff, right, or properly informing them. So the fighters could assume, hey, they're sticking us with this. And the UFC is, no, you didn't read the email. And, because there's also a lot of businesses when you're a contractor, when you're an independent contractor, not a laborer, what they like to do is to push costs on you. Yeah. And even if they volunteer to pick up the cost, they'd like to do it in a way that you might miss that fine point and start paying for it yourself. And so that saves them money. So, but I can't believe that that's that big. For what the UFC makes and all the general costs they have, the tests are pretty low. So I can't, I mean, I might, this reminds me of when they started, remember they first came back after the lockdown, they were going to be the first events and they had that new contract. That the new contract basically it was just draconian where the fighters had to sign over everything to get back to fight. I remember that situation. The UFC wouldn't even comment on that. And then they would be very specific or very, you know, they would, because I remember we did a story on that and we asked for a comment and no one ever, you know, whenever I ask for the UFC for comment, I never get it anyway. So I have to ask someone else then to go ask for comment and see if they'll get it. But there was no comment on that story. Well, we never posted that story that we weren't allowed to. So, okay. And someone else ended up, we sent it to someone else. They did the story. But I remember when that happened and the UFC, the reason I believe the UFC probably is not lying, they just were badly informing fighters, is because of the response to that previous story, how they were, you know, they were very quick to be very quiet about it the first time around.
Well, to me, it seems like they didn't have all of their ducks in a row and released something. I think it's one of two things. They either released something that was unfinished, thinking that it was finished and it wasn't, and somebody leaked it to Ariel, or they had a finished product and they put it out and someone leaked it to Ariel and the blowback was immense. Either way, Ariel has the proof of the policy himself. So I tend to think that the onus of the error is with the UFC. I don't think that Ariel made an error at all. Somebody gave him the policy. And the that's the thing. He had the policy and the original one, the one that he received, was stating that it just basically said that they would have to cover the cost of the COVID testing kit.
Yeah, and, no, if that's the case, then I think, it's very possible that the UFC sent out a message that we're not covering it. And then we're not clear.
Exactly. I mean,
we're still like, oh, we'll reimburse you, but was not clear about that. And people were like, oh, this is bullshit. I'm going to send, I'm going to tell Helwani about this and send him a copy.
Yes. And I think it's either that or maybe they were going to try and stick the fighters with it because of the wording that Hunter Campbell used in the addendum and the email that went out to all the fighters in the corners was basically, we're giving you the choice because of all of these new inexpensive kits that are coming out. why the hell don't you buy the inexpensive kits and save everybody the problem instead of making them buy it out of their money and then you reimbursing them down the line sometime?
Oh yeah, it's possible. I can't quite comment because I haven't followed the story that closely, and no one contacted me about it ahead of time. And usually I get some sense from people like, hey, this is going on, mm-hmm. and I didn't hear anything about that. So no fighter or manager sent me anything. So I think it
happened really, really fast. And yeah. Somebody just was like, hey, what the hell is going on here? But nothing surprises me. And I'm sure nothing surprises you because they are cost cutters. They are so efficient. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole point after the sale was they wanted to cut $50, $60 million in costs. And they're still doing it. They're still looking at cost cutting measures all the time.
You're looking at 2 years in a row where they had record years and they're still trying to figure out ways to snip the corners and at the fighter's expense most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, they had record years, but for the UFC, but what's more important is how Endeavor doing.
And one more time, why is that the most important thing?
Well, because Endeavor is the parent company and the whole purpose of the UFC is to send money to Endeavor to cover the cost of their debts.
Right. All right. So final question today is updates on the antitrust suit and the difference in the two antitrust suits, because we now have two. You briefly mentioned it earlier. One more time for those that are just tuning in.
Okay, well, there's not really much to say about the antitrust suit. There's no real updates. Okay. The judge is apparently waiting for a ruling on the Ninth Circuit concerning another case involving tuna that's been getting kicked. The can's been continuously kicked down the road on that case. And the reason is because that case had a previous court decision about class certification, who can be part of a class certification, and how the court rules on that could set precedent and have affect the UFC case. So now they're kind of waiting for this to get settled before coming back and either saying, oh, I did nothing wrong, we're going to continue with the case and I'm going to issue my class certification opinion, or saying, well, I have to go back and relook at this because this changes the standards for which we're supposed to grant class certification. So that's that. Until that gets settled, we got now, as you mentioned, we have two antitrust lawsuits against the UFC. The first one, which was filed 7 years ago now in December 2014, is headed by Kung Lee, John Fitch, Nate Quarry, Javier Vasquez, Brandon Vera, and Kyle Kingsbury. Those are the six on the original that are left. There were more people originally, but they've been taken off the six. Those are the named plaintiffs. They're down to the core named plaintiffs. That suit covers everybody that fought in the UFC or Azufa promotion from 2014, December 16, 2014, until June 30th, 2017. So about 1,200 fighters. Now, that class action lawsuit has an end date. And it's amazing that the UFC changed their contracts right around that time. But another lawsuit was filed over the summer, and that covers from the period from July 1st, 2017 until now. And it's almost an identical lawsuit, although it will be interesting to see what the changes in the contracts, how they impact that lawsuit.
And is it filed in the same state, the same circuit?
Yep, filed Nevada, same court. They're asking for the same judge to look at it. The two named plaintiffs in it are C.B. Dalloway and Cajun Johnson. And the lawsuit's very close to identical. There's some minor changes. They don't have damages yet. They're asking to go through deposition again, discovery. I don't think they were asking for deposition. They just want basically discovery so that the economic experts can take the information, put it together, and come up with another group of damages for that group of fighters, because they're claiming the UFC scheme that caused the damages is still ongoing, that the UFC has not ended it. And so they still are abusing their monopoly and monopsony power.
All right. Now, you recently did a little something with Vice, and I saw Gray Maynard was a part of that. Can you tell me a little about that?
Yeah, Vice just did a piece about, I guess, the UFC labor conditions, and Gray Maynard was kind of the focus. what happened to his career in the UFC, you know, how little money he made in a championship fight. And so they asked me a few questions, and I make a little cameo at the end describing, you know, it's a spiel that people are, if you've heard me before, probably common. I like to compare the UFC I view it as a microcosm of the current labor conditions for most workers. You know, that it's the UFC is America's sport. You know, baseball was America's pastime, then people thought football was, but I view UFC as America's true real sport, the sport that represents America, because the fighters, the athletes in the UFC and in MMA as a whole, they're the closest to resembling to the typical American worker. Because all the problems that have happened to workers over the economy are magnified in the UFC. You know, we don't have unions. They don't have they're independent contractors. They're gig workers, basically. They work under monopoly power and concentration in the industry and regulatory capture. All those things that are screwing a lot of working class people in America. UFC fighters have to deal with that. Something NBA players and Major League Baseball players really don't have to.
And that really does sum it up in a nutshell. That's a very, very good comparison you draw there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the UFC fighters, they're the most like a typical worker, you know, and like every worker too, they probably don't like their boss.
What would you say if I asked you to compare the UFC's practices with Amazon's practices?
Well, I think there is a lot to compare. I mean, there's vast differences. One's a retail seller and a tech company with a million employees. One's much smaller. But you look at it, UFC's workforce, Amazon is based on the idea that they're going to have a cheap workforce and take over the market. And so they're the only one, or at least the one that sells the most in e-commerce, which they have done. And so they've sold the most. They have the capture of the market in e-commerce, and they also have basically a lot of monopsony power over their workforce, because they set up these warehouses in areas where industry has left. Factories have gone, you know, the basic labor force there. Your options in those towns are very bad fast food or going to Amazon, right? There's not a lot of options for a lot of the people where Amazon situates some of these warehouses. And so the workforce, they do whatever they can to prevent the workforce from forming unions. They treat the workers. They use a lot of independent contractors so that they can push off the benefits and any of the other responsibilities for employers. They push them away just like the UFC does. So they also use their vast monopoly rent, the money they make for lobbying and basically forcing regulatory changes in regions where they want them to show up. And UFC does the same with athletic commissions. So, or lobbying against the Ali Act in Congress. So there's a lot of similarities between all these major companies.
Does the UFC actively union bust?
I don't think they act, not as much as other ones, because they don't have to. I believe they do probably have union bust contractors, but I don't think that's a big concern of the UFC. It's just the fighters themselves, it's very hard to form a union. We've talked about this before. It's kind of impossible. So it takes very little effort to union bust. But I do think they do stuff to try to like prevent fighters from organizing of any sort. I mean, they definitely spend money against lobbying against the Muhammad Ali Reform Boxing that's passed. The Muhammad Ali Expansion Act, they passed, they lobby against that. They lobbied against the Professional Boxing Amendment Act, which was, you know, to add on to the Ali Act just for boxers. But I think they also they have a concerted effort, and they probably have advisors for this, to keep fighters from organizing, if not a union, to organize some sort of an association or collective body to work on pushing stuff that they don't want. And, you know, like the Ali Act, or pushing the professional boxing, the Fighters Bill of Rights in California years ago. So on that front, there's still similarities.
Definitely. Well, John, that's going to bring our time to a wrap. And you know what? It's almost Christmas. Why don't you tell us what your number one fight that you would like to have for Christmas next year? Like, you wish for it this Christmas, it happens, you know, this coming year. What fight would you like to see?
Oh, man, this is a... Yeah, put me on the spot.
I am. But you could also tell me a boxing match if you prefer.
Well, there's a bunch in boxing. I mean, MMA is a little different because some of the fights I'd like to see are impossible to make because you're just not going to get – Antonio McKee is not going to fight anybody in the UFC.
Right.
I would like
AJ
to see –
AJ McKee.
What?
AJ McKee.
Well, yeah.
Antonio is
Jr. is his son.
I know, but you say Antonio, and I immediately think of daddy.
I'm sorry. AJ McKee, Antonio Jr. I want the dad to come back and wrestle hump someone for five rounds in a title match. That's my dream. So I would love to see, I'm trying to think what's a, I get, and okay, in boxing, it's simpler because I would like to basically see any of the lightweights go at it. I'd like to see any of the 135s. If I'd like to see Lomachenko versus Javante Davis. I'd like to see Haney go across and fight Kambosa. And then I'd like to see them fight, maybe get, you know, someone to unify all the titles at that point. Yeah. So I'd like to see that. I would also like to see, I'd like to see Usyk versus Fury at some point next year. Hopefully we get that. And in MMA, I'm going to say, the fight I really want to see, I'm trying to think of non-title matches that I have to see. And I would honestly, the fight I'd really like to see, and it's a Jiri, God dang it, I can't pronounce, who's the light heavyweight, Jiri?
Jiri Prochazka.
Jiri Prochazka, right?
Prochazka.
Prochazka, Jiri Prochazka. Edit that out so I don't sound that dumb. Jiri Prochazka. I would love to see that guy fight John Jones.
Oh, yes.
If not John Jones, then Cyril Gane.
Oh, yeah. I like that, too. I think that's a great match.
That would be a super interesting fight. And then the other one I would love, but we'll never, never get is, I guess I would love to see Khabib come back and fight Usman. I think that would have been interesting, but we're never going to get that. I hope Khabib stays retired. Oh, I know. I would like to see Justin Gaethje. He's going to get Oliveira, which would be great. I mean, I'd love to see that, but I would like to see a rematch with Dustin.
Oh, yeah. I would like that too. That's a great fight. I would also like to see Oliveira and Makhachev right off the bat.
I think McAvoy is going to run. I got a feeling he's going to hold off because he's going to win it. Then we'll be stuck with him for a while. So he's my pick. I think I just feel everybody's keeping the belt warm for him. I don't know why, but I think he's going to.
But he's super dynamic now. He's not the boring fighter that he was when he first.
Oh, no, I don't think he's boring, but I just don't. I'm afraid after he wins that I won't view anybody else as a challenger, a real challenge.
Yeah.
And then so it's like, okay, let these guys, these old timers, kind of fight it out amongst themselves for a little while so we get these big fights. And then let him come in and just run roughshod over everybody. So there's that. And then, I would not mind seeing Max Holloway for a third time against Volkanovski.
Oh, me neither. I would love that.
Yeah. So
absolutely. All right. So real quick, tell us what you got coming up.
As you mentioned, I was on the Vice piece, so that's out there. I was also a couple weeks ago, I was on a week and a half ago, Cardiff Garcia, his show, The New Bazaar. I was on it for an hour talking about finance and face punching. So, yeah, if you didn't get enough of this one, you can go watch that, listen to that for an hour more. and so we got that out. I have I'm on Care Don't Care's on vacation. That's why we're doing this. I guess I'm not on Care Don't Care. If the shoe fits, I was on Tuesday, but I will be off for the holidays. I have an article that's supposed to come out, actually two. One of them, it's kind of, we have to wait for legal, just, nothing wrong with it, but you have to go through legal for that stuff, where I looked at all the new UFC contracts. So awesome. That should come up probably over the Christmas holiday. People can read that and see what the changes are, how it'll impact the business. Beyond that, we just did a new show money, and that should come out on Monday. I don't know what day this comes out, but it should come out.
It's actually out already.
What's that?
It's actually out already.
Oh, is it?
Yep.
Look at that. I miss that. I don't even know. I don't even keep track of that. We do. It's our, we do one show money every 3 months. So four times a year. So enjoy it.
All right. And where are you on social media?
Oh, yeah. If this has not turned you off yet completely, you can find me on Twitter at HeyNotTheFace, where I'll talk fight stuff, but I also go off on weird tangents sometimes. So I got to warn people about that.
They're great tangents, though. They range from anything from movies to politics. I mean, it's quite the melange of everything.
Well, it's mostly me complaining. So,
but it's awesome. You're a good complainer. Okay,
I appreciate it. I appreciate someone enjoys my complaining.
Yes, absolutely. So, on that fine note, we're going to take this show and we're going to wrap it up. And we hope you all have happy holidays. So, until next time, please stay safe.
Thank you for listening to this Bloody Elbow Presents production. To check out more of our content, hop over to the Bloody Elbow Presents SoundCloud and iTunes pages, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is also titled Bloody Elbow Presents. We're also on Apple TV, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, Overcast, Player FM, and Amazon Music. Just search for Bloody Elbow Presents, and you'll get brand new shows throughout the week, including Care Don't Care, The Mookie and Crookie Show, The Best of the Come On Now MMA Podcast, Crooklyn's Corner, The MMA Vivisection, The Level Change Podcast, Show Money, The Sixth Round Post-Fight Show, Sixth Round Retro, The MMA Depressed Us, and Radio Style Play-by-Play for every UFC pay-per-view. You can also follow us on Twitter at Bloody Elbow and on Facebook at facebook.com/Bloody Elbow Blog, and of course on BloodyElbow.com.